Hello, my name is David Lankus from Syracuse University. I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person to enjoy the lovely Connecticut weather. That's either a joke or a compliment, depending on what's going on outside. But the folks were nice enough to give me a 30-minute spot to talk about change management, so I'm able to join you here virtually. As I go around the country and I do a lot of speaking about leadership and change, I've noticed something. That is that talking about leadership, and there's lots of different views of it, is insufficient. That the library field as it is not necessarily facing a leadership crisis so much as a change crisis. We need people who can actively understand how to get us from point A to point B. Now, as a library science educator, I will take full guilt that sometimes what we do in preparing new graduate students is we give them a grand vision of the future, the city on the hill, and say that's where we need to go. And then we give them some technology skills, throw them out the door and say, go make it happen. But that's not enough. We've all encountered innovators and leaders who are all about making grand visions of what the future should look like or setting a strategic direction and then falter when it gets to the point of connecting those dots to get where we are. And that's where change management comes in. What we need to strengthen in our leaders is the ability not only to do the visioning, but to do the planning to get there. And change planning for how we shift people's worldviews, is very difficult and something we shouldn't overlook as a skill that we need to gain. Now, whenever I think of change management, I'm reminded of a former colleague of mine, Jeffrey Katzer, whose whole area is in change management. He had a brilliant joke he used to use, which he said, you know, change is like heaven. Everyone thinks it's a good idea, but nobody wants to go first. That's the situation that we're often in, is that we know we need to change. We're uncomfortable where we are, and we need to go somewhere else. But how do we do that? How do we figure out what's next, what happens? So I want to give you a few ideas about it. And I'm going to do it in the context of innovation. So a few things about innovation. You may be familiar with a graph that looks like this. This is Everett Rogers' Diffusion of Innovation, and it's a bell curve that we use a lot and everyone sort of references. And it talks about, okay, at the beginning you've got innovators. Here are the people who developed the new technology. They're trying to think of something new. And then early adopters, which are crazy people like me, which is if it's got a keyboard and a battery, I'm there. And then after we figure it out and we pay way too much money to get it, everyone else sort of waits for a minute, and then they begin to do the early adoption, so they buy it. That leads to the top of the market, and at the top of the market is normally where you see costs start coming down, you see de facto standards being set, and then the late majority of folks finally get into it, and by the time the laggards are in, you know, they're busy buying Wise Terminal with black screens and green type on them. But there's something interesting about this model that many people don't know, and that is that a fellow by the name of Jeffrey Moore did some work, and what he noticed was when he looked at innovation, he found that there was this sort of growing chasm between the early adopters and the early majority, which is Everett Rogers would make it look like there's this nice little eventual curve, but the truth is that a lot of innovations die right here, that it never makes it to early adoption phase, but the early adopters will get at it. And so what's going on? How do we get people over that hump? The Gartner group doesn't even like this. They talk about our technology. This doesn't really go far enough. And they've developed something called the hype cycle. And I like the hype cycle. But that is that the idea that after the technology happens, there's this growing expectations of what that technology is going to do, and we all believe that it's going to cure cancer, and it's all going to cause world peace, and yay, it's an iPhone, and it's going to, you know, save the universe as we know it. Everyone rushes out, everyone gets their iPhone, everyone gets at it, then they realize that it doesn't in fact cure cancer, and it doesn't in fact cause world peace. Some of you may be sitting in the trough of disillusionment over things like Second Life and virtual worlds right now, where we're all going to be talking and interacting. In fact, this presentation would happen with our avatars, and it hasn't quite shown up that way. Now, give you an example of this. Gartner looked at sort of Web 2.0 technologies that were happening at the time, and they developed, this is sort of where things sit on the hype cycle. So you'll notice if I just highlight a few things here. Right down here at the just beginning to think about, we've got erasable paper printing systems and content delivery architectures and things. We move up to a little fancier stuff like mobile robots. Ooh, that's very exciting. We keep moving up and people are getting their expectations building and building and building around 3D printing, microblogging, which is Twitter. You notice this is in 2008. And then, you know, right, we know that, for example, green IT, the idea of taking technology is going to save us all right up here. And then we begin the terrible crash down where we see things like, well, gee, you know, this whole virtual worlds and Web 2.0 didn't quite live up to what we thought was going to happen. And right at the very bottom, we have things like, well, corporate blogging, which was supposed to, you know, be radical openness of all our corporate, hasn't actually led to increased sales. But then things start crawling up. So even though Bill Gates told us that we would all be working on tablet PCs, didn't quite happen, but now the doctors are finding them, certain people are finding them who need them, and you move over to things like basic web services, where you can do things like embed searches and connect to Amazon and sort of mashup stuff, are places where it's actually finding production going on. So with this technology, we have to ask, how do we get through this cycle? I mean, we've all lived through this cycle. We all have the wounds of this cycle, if you will. People who said, oh, this was going to be it at the top of the technology, then it didn't happen, and then it moved together. So we need to talk about processes to move us through, whether it's Everett Rogers and crossing from early adopters to the early majority, or whether it's us living through the hype cycle. How do we move through that process? And we've all sort of encountered this change management, sometimes in very odd settings. So, for example, there's the seven stages of grieving, from shock and denial and pain and guilt and anger and depression. And so I look at this and think about my hair, for example, when I used to have it. And where am I in terms of, I'm not quite really to acceptance and hope yet, but I'm getting there as my hair disappears. So we've dealt with some of these things. But what's interesting about this, and I don't want to present this necessarily as the model that we should all belong to, but it really says that change has, in scientific terms, we call it an affective dimension. But what it really means is the fact that change affects our emotions and our feelings as much as it changes our workflows and processes. That we have to understand that when we are asking someone to change, we are asking them to change really how they view and interact with their world. And that leads to things like anger and bargaining and depression and these kinds of things. I mean, I have a former employee that when we closed down a project is still grieving for that project 10 years later. Saying, boy, that was going to be the best project, and boy, that was my baby, and boy, that's disappeared. And even though they do great work on new stuff, they've never really gotten over the death of their work activity. And so we have to understand that. So when we talk about change management, we have a couple of contexts. In the whole MIS IT world, if you talk about change management, you're really talking about a specific type of change management. It's a formal procedures to implement code and documentation changes. You deal with things like version control and signing in and out code and change meetings and testing meetings and all these kinds of things. In a broader context, which I'm going to talk about, it really is how to bring about change and innovation, right? It's how to move from that image of the city on the hill to what are the specific steps that we go through to get there. So what I'm going to do is walk through some of those processes. There are a few different examples. I'm going to go through a fellow by the name of Lewin's freeze, change, refreeze, and force fields model. There are many you can find, but I find this one sort of the most conceptually interesting and sort of understandable. Scenario planning, we're going to talk about some different systems approaches then. How do we sort of view the world affects how we view change. So let's start with Kurt Lewin. And Kurt Lewin says, you know, when you go through a change process, you've got to understand that there's a couple of steps. He says the first thing you have to understand, particularly hard for innovators and leaders to understand, is that consistency is actually good, right? It's, for example, we talk about the notion of bureaucracy always in the pejorative. Oh, the bureaucracy got in the way, and all this bureaucracy. Well, there's lots of actually interesting literature in organizational culture and change management that talks about the utility of bureaucracy. For example, you may think that Washington has a huge established bureaucracy that slows things down, but look at countries that have no formal governance and see which you would prefer. Would you like to live in Somalia, where you can become a pirate because there is no official anything? Or do you want to live here, where you can at least assume that while the bureaucracy is irritating, it's at least consistent? So what happens is that people look for these sets of consistencies, that we have employees, and many of you will sort of roll your eyes and say, yes, I have employees who love consistency and will never look for anything different. But that's actually a good thing. If you have someone sort of in the process, in the mix, who does a good job at what they do, they are frozen. They have really sort of locked down their world so that they have things that they can understand and predict, and that helps them get through their life. And we all look for that. We all look for some consistency going on. So what we have is a frozen present. And there's some issues with being really good at what you do. And this is something that I think a lot of people also don't think about in terms of leadership and change management. When you're really good at what you do, it is actually harder to change to something else. I mean, think about it. If you look at something like Microsoft Encarta versus Wikipedia, and you put yourself in 2004, and you say, all right, we're going to build us an encyclopedia. And we're going to look at these two encyclopedias. Which would you have predicted would sort of be the number one used, thought about internet resource and the one that's closing its doors in October? It probably wouldn't have been, well, Microsoft, that has a huge established base from its CD-ROM product, has a huge marketing budget, has all these experts and editors online, will be closing in October. And Wikipedia, which is a bunch of people with a keyboard who just can make up anything they want, that's going to be what succeeds. Now, in retrospect, from 2009, we can look back and go, of course, because it's radical openness and it's the idea of people being able to change the thing they want. But the idea here is that Microsoft did not fail because it was bad at encyclopedias. Once again, they dominated the market. They put World Book and Britannica basically out of business in the K-12 domain because of their CD-ROM product. They were really good at encyclopedias. So good that when they went to these internet environment, they didn't know how to adjust. They kept doing what they were good at. And so what we have to understand is that being frozen, we might look at that and say that's a bad thing, but ultimately it's usually frozen because it's success. And by trying to move someone to a different model, we're asking them to get out of their success to make a new one. And so what Lewin says is the way you do that is you take someone who's really successful at what they currently do, and you make them nervous. I mean, it's sort of, we like to think that it's all happy and fun-loving and kumbaya land. But he says what you really need to do is you need to make them uncomfortable with where they are. You need to say, you know, yes, you're doing a great job here, but if you keep doing that, you know, the world as we know it will end. You need to unfreeze them. Now, once again, this is where you say, oh, well, once again, we got this city on the hill, we're all going to go, let's go. If you stay here, you're going to be left behind. Let's go. And so one of the issues is, yes, you need to make them uncomfortable where they are. But the other thing Lewin says, and equally important, is you need to make it very attractive to go where you need them to go. Right? If you have an ideal state, you need to make the current state uncomfortable and the ideal state seem comfortable. And in the middle, from the present to the desired, is this change. And it's always turbulent. Always turbulent. So moving from the present to a desired means uncomfortable with the present, comfortable or at least attractive to the future, and understanding that you're going to go through a turbulent process in between. But then what he says is very important, which is once you get people to a desired norm, you must refreeze them. You must, in essence, give them consistency in the new. And so once again, I think we have lots of examples of leaders who get people very excited about change. Get them uncomfortable with the present, and then you have a bunch of people who are really uncomfortable with where they are. They sort of don't understand where they're going, and they certainly don't understand how to act in the new world. And so what we need to worry about is to get them to the new environment, we need to understand what policies and procedures do we need in place. Not risk avoidance policy and procedures. What evaluation criteria? In other words, give them something that they can latch on in the new setting to say, okay, I can understand, I can get around this, I can regularize and routinize what I'm doing. So it's one thing to make them uncomfortable. It's one thing to attract them, but you need both of those. I mean, I do a lot of speaking in library land, and I'm sure you've been at many conferences with the prophets and demigods who stand up and very loudly say, thou shalt blog, thou shalt do this, thou shalt do that, whatever the new thing we're supposed to do. And that's about attracting them to a new future. But then they get off the stage, and everyone walks around very uncomfortable that they're not blogging, but not quite sure how to blog again in the future. So this idea of, think about, uncomfortable with where you're going, uncomfortable with where you are, comfortable with where you're going, and then a turbulent period in between. So you have to think about how to unfreeze them where they are and refreeze them where you want them to go. Now, the other thing that Lewin talks about is something what he calls the force field model. And that is, with any change, with any of this unfreezing and refreezing, there are always these dynamic forces going on. Within individuals, within organizations. There are driving forces. These driving forces are forces that, got the technology, might as well use it. Driving forces are the forces that want to change. right? So they're saying they can be weak, they can be strong, they can be very strong, right? And these forces say, we're supposed to change, we must change. We see this right now with the healthcare debate. Where we're going right now is not going to work, we need to move to XYZ. There are at the same time forces that are restraining forces, and they can be weak and moderate and strong. And these forces say, no, what you need, the status quo is good, or this isn't what should happen. And in the middle exists an equilibrium. And that equilibrium, sorry about this, right there, is sort of sometimes comfortable depending on how strong the forces are on both sides. If they're weak forces for change on both sides, the equilibrium's fine. Or it can be really contentious. If there are strong forces on both sides, it's sort of uncomfortable to be anywhere. And what you need to do is once one of these forces gets stronger than the other, you're either going to lead to change, the driving forces outweigh the restraining forces, or you're going to have no change, the restraining forces win. And what you need to do as a manager in a change management process is to first investigate the balance of power involved in an issue. In other words, it's not enough to have a grand vision. You also have to find out what other stakeholders are doing, what they have invested in this. Identify the most important players and target those groups for a campaign on the issue, specifically reach out to them. Identify the opponents and allies, and then identify how to influence each target group. Right? So it's divide and conquer. Find out who's with you, who's against you, what they want to get out of it, and then how can you incent it. Now, Lewin gives, and I apologize, this is probably not readable, but I'll just run through it, sort of 11 steps to think about in doing this, from describing the current situation, describing the desired situation, identifying where what the current situation will go if there's no action. If we don't do anything, this is what's going to happen. List all the forces that are driving it, resisting it. Discuss and interrogate all the forces. Are they valid? Can they be changed? Which ones are critical? Allocate a score to each of these forces from extremely weak to extremely strong. Chart those forces against each other. Determine whether change is viable and you can even go. Discuss how to change the affected, how change can be affected by either decreasing the strength of the restraining forces or increasing the strength of your driving forces. But, 11, keep in mind that driving forces, if you increase or decrease these forces, you may change the whole balance or create new ones. If you take one player out of the equation, a new player may have room to come in. So, Lewin presents this idea that change is a process where you go through freezing, changing, and refreezing, that the ability to make that jump, to sort of go over that turbulent mode, to go through Gartner's hype cycle, for example, to cross the chasm between early adopter and early majority, is a matter of finding these forces and the forces are acting upon them. And he has a really pragmatic way of sort of, you identify the stakeholders, you find out what they want, you find out how strong they are, and then you determine sort of semi-mathematically how you can move ahead or not move ahead. There are other approaches to change management, other approaches to getting you where you need to go. One of which is sort of famous, is scenario planning. And I like scenario planning because it's a very inclusive process. It brings lots of people in. And it goes something like this. You decide on your assumptions and your drivers for change. So in other words, just like Lewin said, you start by charting out what's going to change and who's going to change and where they're going to change. You say, what are the drivers? Well, technology is a driver. Budget is a driver. Workforce is a driver. The union, whatever it is. You bring those drivers together into a variable framework, meaning if the technology becomes cheaper and that's a trend and we get our budgets increase, we can drive change this way. Think of sort of the rich technology future versus if technology gets cheaper but our budgets get constrained, it's the status quo. You produce an initial 7 to 9 mini scenarios. Well, what could happen in the future? Given these drivers, given these changes, if one increases or one decreases, where can we go? Reduce those down to 2 or 3, write them up, and then identify any issues arise from them. But what's nice about this is like bringing together a bunch of people around a table, and instead of saying, here's the grand vision of the future, it's a little bit more calculated. You're bringing together the people and you're saying, well, what's going to drive us towards any future? And depending on how we can affect those drivers, what could happen? Right? So it's a little bit more, instead of just thinking where we want to go, what's going to get us there and what's the forces going to get us there? This is a scenario plan that Scott Nicholson put together as part of a digital reference research agenda. And he said there's a couple of forces going on that we need to think about. He said the first force that we need to worry about is funding. where, not so much bigger or smaller, but where the funding comes from, public or commercial interests, is one driver. If funding for virtual digital reference is coming from a public sector, it will go in one way. If it comes from the commercial sector or commercializing force, it will go in a different way. He then said the other major driver that's going on is automation. There are really different theories about where automation can come in. Some people feel that the whole value of virtual reference is in having humans. In other words, minimize automation or use automation to increase human-to-human interaction. And others feel that, no, what we're really pushing towards in virtual reference is increased automation because we're expecting too many questions and we need the computer to do work for us. So given those drivers, he then laid out a couple of scenarios. And so the first one that he laid out was, if we have the drive for the human coming from public funding, we'll end up with the sort of digital reference desk that we have now. People online answering questions, taking the next in queue. He says, on the other hand, if what we have is a human push for human automation but commercial funding, then we end up with something he calls the Universal Answer Center. And it's the notion of, we've seen a couple of these services, but you call, 1-900-ANSWER-ME-THIS, and this whole fleet of question answers exist, and they charge you 5 cents an answer, $5 a call, what have you. On the other hand, he says, if you take something like a push for systems for automation and public funding, we're going to end up with AutoRef library services. We're going to have lots of pathfinders, but our pathfinders and our frequently asked questions are going to be automated so that we can do a really good search on them. So when you ask a question in natural language, up will pop a bunch of suggestions. And then once again, he says, on the other hand, if what you have is a push for automation and a push from the commercialization, you end up in a world of the Giga Search Service, which is kind of scary because this sounds a lot like where we're going, right? This is when Microsoft rebranded Live Search and called it Bing. Bing talks about itself being a knowledge engine or an answer engine, right? This is where Google's trying to get more and more automated way of answering questions. So the truth is that the scenario will exist somewhere in between all of these. But it's a way of you thinking about, all right, if this is where we want to go, then how do we make that happen? So let's put that in a little bit more practical framework. If we take something like, how do we develop an agenda for action? Well, taking all these ideas, Lewin's ideas and scenario planning, all this back and forth, how do I put this in action? Well, start with an analysis of where you are today, right? So our library is at this budget, serving this many people with these kind of constraints today. And then if these trends continue, whatever the trends that you find significant, budget trends, technology trends, demographic trends, what have you, this is what tomorrow will look like. If we do nothing, this is the predicted future. And I'll tell you, I teach doctoral students, and they have a real hard time understanding that there's anything else other than this line. That their job is to go gather a bunch of data about what's happening and then saying, well, this is what's going to happen. But that's not what good research does, and that's certainly not what good planning does, and that's not what a good leader does. What a good leader does is they develop an ideal future. This is where we want it to go. Now, the closer you can get between your ideal future and your predicted future, what I've listed here is the gap, the better your life is, right? Because if you're already headed to your ideal future, good luck, keep going. On the other hand, if it's really wide apart, you have something to do. You have this sort of action thing going on. So I'll give you an example. The MacArthur Foundation asked me to go and look for what is the future of libraries. And I asked a bunch of people together, and I finally had someone, David Pimentel, brilliant doctoral student, who said, are you really asking what is the future of libraries or what should the future of libraries be? And I think that's a question we need to ask ourselves. The should means we're in control. What is makes it sound like it's fate. It's going to happen. So my question to you is, if you looked at that today and that predicted future and it was our library goes away, are you okay with that? Are you comfortable with that? Or do you say, no, the ideal future is that our library becomes more and more important. And so what do we need to do in order to get from where it's headed to where we need to go? Well, there are tasks, right? Well, first we need to raise awareness, increase budget, better market our services, better demonstrate their impact, tie it to economic outcomes or tie it to student outcomes in education settings, what have you. And from this you get your agenda, right? So think about this for a moment. I think we do a lot of trying to predict the future. And as Alan Kay once said, my favorite quote, which is, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. Don't feel like you're a victim to the future. Feel like you can come up with the ideal future. And then, going back to all the stuff we talked about before, once I have this ideal future, I need to make people uncomfortable with that bottom line, where we're headed now or where we currently are. Understand I'm going to walk through turbulence, but then make the ideal future as real and predictable as possible to the individuals who don't have that vision side, and what steps they need to go to achieve it. Right? How do we get from point A to point B? How do we go from our library does a great job serving young children and middle-aged population, but we totally miss the teens and we totally miss this group. How do we get that middle section? Our ideal future is we serve them all. Okay. We need to identify what questions they're asking, where they're asking, how do we go about it, etc. And it puts you in control. That's the other thing. Now, I want to be careful. I don't want to leave you with the, all right, just go do this and you'll change thing, because the future, unfortunately, is not as predictable as that. As we know, where we think it's going and where it ends up is not so predictable. This is sort of this idea that I can actually manage, change, and control all the variables comes from a very old way of looking at systems. The takeaway from this whole thing is that change and innovation can be managed. But you must recognize that you must first recognize a problem, and you must propose a solution, but that is insufficient. It's not enough to say this is wrong, and it's not enough to say this is right. You have to understand how to get from wrong to right. And this is one of my favorite lines. Don't rally the troops until you're ready to give marching orders. One of the things we do a lot in, I say library land, but just about any organization I've ever been at, is we're really good at saying, this is what's wrong, we need to change. They're really good at dire conclusions. If we don't change, we'll be out of business. And at the same time, we're also pretty good at, here's the grand, glorious vision. If we do this, if we say radical openness, if we allow anyone to come in and edit our catalogs, life will be better. But where we break down is in the process to get from one or the other. Librarians are great at procedure. We're addicted to procedure. We're great at routinizing things. Well, we need to turn that effort where we routinize current tasks into a way of routinizing a process and change management procedure. We have methods to prepare for change, but we must always understand that change is a dynamic process, that we must constantly monitor our agenda and see if we need to change it and what new factors and new forces. So there you go. I'm sorry, once again, I couldn't be there in person, but I believe that libraries are at a point where we can change the world. And what's more important to me is that I believe that this moment in history, this moment in time, this moment that librarians are looking at, and the skills that we bring to them is a moment of our choosing. And the destiny and the way in which we change, that agenda, that preferred future that we set up, is of our choosing. And yes, it will be influenced by many other people, but we must look at the idea and say, yes, it's messy and there are going to be lots of other factors, but that does not exempt us from the ability to set up where we're headed, to convince you that that's the right place to go. Libraries can't sit back and say, we have a grand vision, or worse, sit back and say, tell us what your vision is and we'll serve you to get there. Libraries have the ability to come together as a group, say, this is where we are frozen. This is where we can go. Here are the steps that we will take and we will understand and we will recreate librarianship, because the best day of libraries are ahead of us, not behind us. But only if we take the time to identify that ideal future, the steps to get there, and mobilize to get there. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy the rest of the day. If any of this didn't make sense, or if any of you want to encounter it, please let me know. Email me whenever you need. Good luck. Thank you.